politically incorrect.
Correct.
This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on TNT Radio.
Hello, everybody. Mike Tennessee here. Richard's with me again, as usual. Nice to have you company again, Richard. But more especially, we've got Alistair Pope. Now, you may recall a couple of weeks ago, we had Alistair on the program. Lieutenant Colonel Alistair Pope.
Retired.
Retired, yes, but I don't think he seems to be terribly retired.
He's not retired at all. He's very forthright.
Exactly. Well, anyway, for those who haven't heard Alistair before, he's a military man. He has served in Vietnam, Indonesia, and Papua New Guinea as a subunit commander in the 3rd Brigade in Townsville. He retired in 1986, but he founded his own business working internationally as a project manager until he actually seriously retired in 2016. Welcome again, Alistair. Very nice to see you again and to listen to you. Now, we've got some interesting topics to talk about this afternoon, because maybe morning, wherever somebody else might be listening. However, those topics include such things as what Australia's been doing in the way of defence expenditure or otherwise. And it's really topical, isn't it? Because we've got this situation now in the Pacific with the Chinese connection with the Solomon Islands. We'll come to that shortly. But, of course, that's designed, apparently, according to the Chinese people, to maintain social stability, realise sustainable development, and address traditional and non-traditional security issues. That's an interesting little sentence, isn't it?
Plenty of options there, Mike.
There is, huh? There's certainly many options. Alistair, we were talking about some of the foibles of what we in Australia have had to go through in terms of our defence expenditure and planning. So I wanted to ask you if you could elaborate on your views about why we've had some continuous failures and whether or not it's the norm here. Why and how organisational and structural difficulties prevent acquisition success by the military. What can you say about that?
Okay, well, thanks for having me back. I thought after the last talk I gave, you might have had so many people depressed that you wouldn't have me back again. However,
no, they bounced back, Alistair. They bounced back. They were on the canvas, but they came back up. So we're here for another wide-ranging dissertation with your knowledge. So we look forward to hearing it.
All right. Well, I'll start with the structural difficulties. Now, if you actually have a look at the Americans, they are not much better, but they've got a lot more money. So when you find out that they've got what I call the Goldilocks projects for their undersea warfare, they actually planned in three types of unmanned artificial intelligence submarines. Now, the large one is the Orca, and that's one of the ones that we should certainly be buying. It has a range of 6,500 kilometres. It can go up to the South China Sea and back again without ever surfacing. It has no people on board, and it works entirely through artificial intelligence, and it is armed. Then they have the small one, which is basically a protective underwater vehicle, unmanned underwater vehicle, UUV, for a submarine itself. So when it detects someone is actually looking for it, it can actually dispatch this thing to go and take care of whoever is looking for it. And then they had the medium-sized one. They had said the Goldilocks solution, the big bear, the middle bear, and the mama bear, and the baby bear. Well, they've cancelled the middle one. And that is through... I've actually been researching this, actually. It was actually through absolutely appalling project management and program management, almost to the quality of our defense organization in the number of mistakes they made and how they made them. So they've cancelled that middle one, but as they point out, they've got the big one, the little one are still going ahead, and the Orca is actually now in service. They've just commissioned the first four of them. Now, why do we end up with this sort of situation? One of the reasons is that we silo our projects. So if you're, say, building a ship, the person who's building the hull is not responsible for the power pack, the engine. So if someone else is doing the engine, then someone else is doing the weapons, someone's doing the communications, and someone's doing all of that. And they don't coordinate these things together very well because they're all in their own silos. In fact, I came across one case many years ago where one project manager in one area didn't like the project manager in another area, so he simply withheld information, which meant the ship would sort of sail like a canoe. The weight system of it was not going to be right. And that was purely internal politics. Now, we don't really have someone sitting across the whole top of this. Secondly, there's another major issue here that, and I'll give you there's a great example actually with the vehicles actually that were bought for special forces. Now, I know you two guys are incredibly rich. So how much would you pay for a superb vehicle? What would you be willing to pay? A Bentley would cost you how much, for instance?
550.
Okay, I know you've got one. So you've got a Bentley there.
I haven't got one, but I discovered that was the price the other day, and I thought, heavens, I've got a $9,000 vehicle, which was just outside my price bracket, that one.
Okay. Well, the Special Forces put out their requirements for a new Special Forces vehicle, and they had such a range and so much ammunition, everything else. And then it got into the hands of BMO and the other people there. So they ended up spending, to buy one of these things, is $3.75 million. And by the way, the Special Forces rejected it. Let me give you the reasons why. Now, you've all seen old movies. And the vehicle gets blown up and everyone gets thrown in the air. And then they land and they shake themselves off and they get up and they go back to the battle. They must have been seeing this type of thing because the driver of this new Special Forces vehicle sits right over the wheel. So when the wheel goes over a landmine, he loses his legs. So maybe we have to recruit legless soldiers to be the drivers of these things. Secondly, the South Africans invented the boat hull, where they have the shape of a boat hull underneath. So when an IED goes off, this actually dissipates the explosion. So when you've got something like the Bushmaster, which was the world's best light armored vehicle, we didn't get anyone killed in one. And yet we had quite a considerable, dozens of them actually hit mines in Iraq and Afghanistan, but nobody was killed because the explosions were actually dispersed and the heavy armor under the vehicle actually meant they weren't penetrated. So they didn't do that. They put a flat base under this. So this will, in fact, become a missile when an IED goes off under it.
Alistair, are these made here in Australia?
Yeah, they're being designed and was to be built here in Australia.
We've had a better design and now we've come backwards.
No, we got rid of the design. We sold the Bushmasters to the Americans.
Oh, good.
Who now have created apparently about 2,000 of them and sell them to other countries. We do this on a regular basis. Thirdly, this Special Forces vehicle has no nuclear, biological, or chemical protection. So in some areas you might have to go to where you need to have NBC suits. Now, the idea was that even the Humvee was sealed, and so the filters actually would take out all the biological stuff and give you fresh air. But now, in fact, this thing has got no cover whatsoever. So if you're driving around in the hot desert anywhere in, say, Iraq or even in North Australia, you'll probably die of heat stroke. Or you'll freeze to death with frostbite, or you'll get drowned in wet weather. Sandstorms, never been one in Canberra, so they didn't actually take this into account.
Oh, Jesus.
Fourthly, the driver sits right over the wheel. I said, when the IED goes off, he dies. Fifthly, when the gun mount on the roll bar, this is about where the guy with the gun is supposed to, they're definitely bopping through the track here, and an enemy sees them and fires at them. So they've got no protection. There's no armor around the gunner. But anyway, let's say he survives the first 300 rounds that come at him. He turns around, and the guy happens to be on the right, so he has to turn the gun to the right, and he sprays him with the machine gun on the roll bar. And all the hot, expensive rounds land on the driver. Now, if you've ever picked up a round just after it's been fired, it really is hot.
Yeah, I have done that. Yeah, you're right.
So in fact, you tell the driver, don't worry about the hot, red hot things that are hitting the back of your head. Keep your eyes on the road. So, the gun mount there was just insanely placed. Sixthly, there's a total lack of protection for the gunner and the passengers. So they're totally exposed. They might as well be driving a convertible down the road there into a war zone.
I mean, how can that happen? I mean, that's just beyond comprehension that we would spend 3.7 million.
What happens is that people keep changing the specification. The special forces gave the specification, and then somebody comes along and says, no, we can save money by not putting a roof on this thing. We can move the driver's seat just like any Ford Motor Company or Holden or whatever else, where he sits right over the wheel. And so people get involved in this, and they actually tend to actually change things without referring back to the original specification and the people who actually wanted it and why. And so we end up changing anything. I don't think we've ever bought anything off the shelf overseas without changing it. We bought the Leopard tanks, and we ended up with, I think it's called the Leopard G, because it was a unique, we made so many modifications, it was a unique vehicle. The nearest one that anyone else had that looked like it was someone in Greece. So we tend to change these things. The other thing is, of course, that these things continue then with all the changes. The costs keep going up. And so you start off with a vehicle that's perhaps going to cost you $500,000 each, which would still be expensive, but it's heavily armored, to something that ends up costing you $3.75 million and is totally unfit for purpose. Let me give you one example, a very simple example I was involved with.
I'll be back on the canvas in no time.
Here's a very simple one that I was actually involved in way back in the 1980s. We wanted a cold weather sleeping bag. So this is something you could wear and sleep out in snow. And so we were going to actually test these up in the Mount Hotham in midwinter. Now, somebody came up with the idea, quite rationally as it might sound, that the sleeping bag had to be waterproof. Because you might not be able to put up a tent or a little hoochie over you. So they actually put this thing around. It wasn't Gore-Tex or anything like that. They actually sort of wrapped it in plastic. So when the soldiers that we sent up there got into this thing at night, I don't know if you realize it, but you actually sweat.
Yeah.
And they ended up with an enormous amount. You can lose about a kilo of sweat during the night when you're sleeping in bed.
Yeah, that's
right. That evaporates off and disappears. Not in this case here, it was now stuck inside the sleeping bag. And these guys either, one, nearly froze to death because the water in there started to become
frozen,
ice, or two, when they got out of it, they would turn to ice and freeze, or three, they drowned. And yet, that was a modification that someone said, oh, it should be waterproof. And suddenly, we ended up with something that was utterly unsuitable for purpose. Yet you could have gone down to Paddy Palin, or whatever his name is,
yep,
and bought a sleeping bag out of there that you can sleep on the top of Mount Everest in.
Exactly, because you can't put plastic on the outside because then the whole show won't breathe.
That was the problem. It didn't.
I can fully understand what you're telling me, but I cannot comprehend that our military minds could be that.
Scientific mind in this case.
Oh. So we are talking structural difficulties in the Defence Department for acquiring product. You've given me two in a row that are a complete disaster.
Yes. Well, there's many more.
Oh, please tell me about some more. Mike, we need to hear about these things. It sounds like some of the racehorses you and I have had an association with.
Yeah, very slow runners, I believe. Anyway.
Some beat the others, and others sometimes don't win, do they?
Well, they keep an eye on the ones in front. They're very good. Right. Night horses. Keep going. Well, Alistair, please.
To give you an example, actually, I would think the Israelis are fairly good at the command and control systems. I mean, they keep taking on armies that are six times larger than they are, and they keep winning.
Yep.
And they offered us their command and control system, but they wouldn't give us everything. There were certain parts of it that they would keep secret. We spent $960 million investigating this command and control system and then rejected it on the grounds, as far as I hear, on the grounds that the parts we couldn't get to may very well have Trojans in it that would allow the Israelis to see what we were planning. Might be right, but I don't think the Israelis were on the enemy side.
So the $9 million... In terms of working out whether or not it was any good, you're saying that something like over $9 million.
$960 million.
$960 million.
Investigating how it would work. Is that right?
Yep. Then we cancelled it.
How do you spend that sort of money investigating something?
I think that's a very good question. But
I'll get back to you on that one. Richard. Well, I mean, we spent $9 billion on the submarines we're not going to have.
I don't bring that up again.
No, we were enthralled with that one last time. But
well, I'm truly some.
You've got a program that works for the Israelis. We spend $960 million having a look at it, poking around, and then get a fright, so we shelve the whole bloody thing.
Yeah.
This is...
We're now back to plastic maps with, you ever go and watch the Battle of Britain, you know, we will have little things there. We push along with a stick saying this is where the enemy is.
Yeah.
I don't know what we're currently using. I mean, I'm a bit out of date in what we'd probably be using. I doubt if we've got anything. I think actually if that was what we were going to have for the command control system.
When did this fiasco happen recently?
That was this year.
Oh, my God. So we spent $9.5 billion on a submarine we couldn't get or didn't want or whatever happened there. And we spent 900 plus 960 million investigating a structure that we then totaled because we didn't think that we wanted the Israelis to see what we were having for a cup of tea.
The interesting thing was the Auditor General looked at it and they told him actually that it was actually running 7 months late. 3 months later, they said it's actually slipped to 12 months late because we wanted modifications to a system that's being used in real life to defend the nation, being used in real battlefields. We know it works. And by the way, I mean, this goes on. In the terrorism world, the police are another good example of that, actually, because the AFP was looking at a system based on something invented by an Australian naval officer. And have you ever heard of the 6 degrees of separation?
I have.
Well, what he basically came up with was that we're only separated by 6 degrees or 6 steps from everyone else in the world, all 9 billion of us or 7 billion of us or whatever.
7 going on 8, yep.
Yep, all right. 8 billion people. Well, he actually came up with that and he came up with the system and he tested it and found that it actually happened. They could give someone to an African native and they could get to someone in New York in only 6 steps. Now, that is used as an intelligence system of who do you talk to, who do you know? You can build that up as a huge matrix. And we rejected that. And I know the reasons why, actually, but I won't go into them here. But again, the Israelis actually had taken that idea and developed it so they could build a picture of terrorist networks. And yet we rejected that for keeping track of intelligence about who we knew and who was involved in any sort of terrorism.
Why would we reject that idea? We didn't want to know them all.
No, actually, I'm not quite sure. Actually, I know the person, the particular officer actually did reject it, but I've never heard the reasons why. But they basically said it wasn't suitable for Australian conditions.
It looks like we've got a policy that nothing's suitable for Australian conditions because we don't end up with anything.
Well, there was one particular case, actually, where the Israelis informed us of a potential terrorist act that was going to take place on New Year's Day in Melbourne.
I remember that. Now, Alistair, before you go on, we're going to go to a break.
Okay.
But we will keep that in mind. We'll come back to that.
You keep it in mind.
That's a very interesting point.
Very good.
We're going to go to a break now, Richard, and we'll come back very shortly.
Thank you.
You should hear what Misty Winston is talking about.
I want to actually talk a little bit about the class divide with you because I think that, you just mentioned the class war. And we are in, I don't think people recognize it, we are in a class war and have been for some time. The middle class, the working class, we perhaps have been unaware of the fact that we're in a class war, but that's been going on for a long time. So let's talk a little bit about that and the class divide. Well, how do you see things right now? Because I feel like right now there's a lot of distractions being thrown our way to kind of prevent us from noticing the man behind the curtain.
Right. I think people really need to pay attention to what's going on economically in this country. And I don't just mean in reference to inflation. For example, I talked about this the other night. Bill Gates is actually buying farmland in the United States, a lot of farmland. And there was a woman that came on my show about 2 weeks ago, and she was telling me that Bill Gates is stealing water from her town.
Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Everybody's terrified of cancer, the big C. They don't want to talk about embarrassing things, so blood in their bowel motions, going more frequently, a persistent cough, losing weight. I remember a wee man who didn't come to my surgery for ages, and all he would do was apologise and say, "Oh, sorry, doctor, I know if I had come, I know you'd have got me sorted." We are not too busy. We are very, very keen to see our patients as soon as we possibly can. So please don't get scared. Get checked.
The bushfire was so unpredictable, it was important to have a plan.
We stayed up to date with our phones and the radio. We knew it was coming.
I never thought it would actually happen. I'm glad we had a plan.
You have to prepare your property and your family.
Always had a plan.
We can all be bushfire ready. Do your 5-minute bushfire plan today.
News more twisted than soap operas.
Ugh.
And with worse actors.
You can't be serious.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson. And we've got Alistair Pope on the line as well. Alistair, we were talking about plans. You were talking about the intelligence from the Israelis about a proposed terrorist attack in Melbourne. Let's go back to that. It's an interesting point you're making.
All right, well, what happened was that the Israelis contacted and said there's a likely terrorist attack. And the reaction was, how did you find that out? Have you been spying on us? No. We actually got it from the other end. And in fact, the only investigation the initiative started into is how the Israelis were possibly spying on us, not to take care of the fact that someone was going to blow up a number of people in the middle of Melbourne. So we totally missed the outcomes, but we looked at the process and we started accusing the Israelis of spying on us. And they actually pointed out that they actually had been spying on someone else at the other end who had contacted this person in Melbourne to carry out this terrorist act. So they weren't spying on Australian, but they were spying on someone else. But we were offended that they might be looking at us.
Alistair, why are we so defensive on everything that happens? Is there a bloody some complex within the Defence Department, or what the heck's wrong with them?
No. I mean, it doesn't really matter. I mean, when you look at all of the equipment we're actually getting and all the things that we're involved in, it's actually across the board. It's just that the Israelis happen to have some very effective equipment, but they haven't been able to sell very much of it to Australia because we have demands on them that are unacceptable to the Israelis. No, you're not going to change that. We spent 9 years developing this and it works, but you want to change it, and we're not going to accept the changes. So we said, well, we'll do without it. We don't want it. But we actually modified just a bit of it. We modified the Leopard tank to death, and it was a very good tank, by the way. It came up with a particular concept at the time. And now we bought the Abrams, which has a number of reasons is unsuitable for the way that we currently carry out our operations. It's a better tank than the Leopard, but it has a different way of operating. It's heavily armored, much heavier armored. And the idea is it shouldn't be hit. Now it can be hit, but we'll continue to be able to fight. Now, that was in the days before drones and Hellfire missiles that come down vertically and hit the weakest part of the armor, which is on the top.
Well, heavens above. Alistair, I mean, let's face it, if there was to be a war, and let's hope there's never a war, how would it be fought, in your view? And I mean, why...
And how are we prepared to cope with it?
Yeah, how are we going to be prepared to fight it?
I mean, this is my opinion. There's obviously geniuses and poor fumbles who would give you a different opinion of all of this. But
they're not making me confident.
Sorry?
On their current performance of 1 to 100, they're very close to zero.
I tend to have made that sort of assertion a number of times, which means I'll never be Governor General. One of the issues is that war is always changing. So when you look at it, let me go back very historically. The way to win a war was to have a phalanx. And that was a word where you had 30-foot spears, 18-foot spears, 12-foot spears, and you charged at the enemy, and they couldn't get at you because of this hedgehog. Then this went on for decades. Then somebody called Alexander came up with the idea, why don't we ride round the side of them with cavalry and attack them from the side? Because you can't turn around all these spears. So suddenly the phalanx was completely useless because you could simply have heavy and suddenly heavy cavalry became the answer to all of the war fighting. Then, of course, people come along with better and better weapons to take down heavy cavalry. The armor, when the crossbow was invented, it was the first type of weapon that could actually penetrate the armor that knights were wearing. So the armor got heavier, and when you knocked a knight down, he couldn't get up.
He was gone.
So then you came along with this halberd, which is a big spike in the end, and brained him with it. So that sort of changed that for a while. And so this has basically been changing. Then along came weapons, and it took us a while to realize that charging machine guns head on was a really, really bad idea. But we continued to do that right up till 1918, when the Germans were the first to change the tactics into their stormtrooper tactics, where you came up with small groups and sneaked in rather than charging head on into machine guns. And they nearly succeeded in April 1918. However, so things have continued to change, but what we did in Australia in the 1970s, we didn't have an enemy who was going to attack us. It wasn't going to be Indonesia, New Zealand, or Fiji, as far as I know. So we invented one called the Missourians. And it was very much like a Russian army. It was heavily armored. It had armored infantry. And so we then started to build our defenses based on this mythical army from Orangeland. And so that meant we needed tanks, we needed a conventional division, we needed all of these sort of things. And yet, I was actually thinking of it even then. I said, hang on, except for North Africa, where we didn't have any armor of our own, by the way. We never took the armored division from World War II. It never went overseas. So apart from World War II, when we had the infantry divisions in the Middle East, we have never fought a divisional side operation of the type that we were planning to fight in the 1970s. The only difference was we were planning to fight on Australian soil instead of someone else's country. And that was the guiding force for the structure of the army. So we ended up with an infantry division of 9 battalions, in which case we deployed a brigade, 3 battalions to Vietnam. And then the second one was training to go, and the third one was stripped out of its manpower, and it had 2 years to then get itself back up to speed. So basically we had one operational brigade from, say, about 1945 right through until basically today.
Are we growing that, or we just got the same?
No, it's about the same. But we'd be lucky. We couldn't field a brigade right now. We would have to actually have some form of conscription again if you wanted to put a brigade into a long-term commitment such as Vietnam. So that's the situation we're in now. Yet we're going to go off and buy another 78 tanks. And yet here's where the face of war has changed. By the way, tanks are not obsolete. You just have to use them in a different way. I was watching actually just a couple of days ago an incredibly good video from Ukraine, where, firstly, drones were taking out tanks. We know they can do that. So we've got to have a counter weapon to that if you're going to use tanks. But the other thing that impressed me was the Ukrainians were firing one round of artillery and it would hit a tank. They'd fire another one round and it would hit another tank. Now, that was pretty good news. If you remember the barrages of World War I and the 3 million
thousands of bloody shells going everywhere.
Yeah, now they fire one round and it takes out the target. How is it done? Well, we now have guided artillery. You fire the round and it picks up a GPS signal and then goes to the target where it's been nominated in a grid reference, and it will land in a space of about 3 meters. And in fact, that will be improved suddenly. My first car with a GPS in it used to be 100 meters. Then it got down. The one I've got now has got 50 meters. They tried to sell me one the other day with a 10-meter GPS. And I mentioned this to someone, and he actually got out his mobile phone and looked up Google, and he stepped one pace away and the dot on the phone moved. It was 1 meter. Wow. That's how accurate they're getting now. So when you actually fire a round, previously we had to sort of saturate the area because we couldn't hit things with more than about 30, 40 meters accuracy. Now, this particular gun, it was actually called the Excalibur, actually was firing a round that would actually take out a tank with one round. 30 tanks come throttling down the road, 30 rounds, you take them out.
Yeah, well, that's a bit of a problem, isn't it? For as we're asking, you know, there's a changing face of war, and how and what are we likely to be facing? And our equipment that we have doesn't seem to be up for the job.
No, it's not.
When I talk to you, I do fall on the canvas thinking we've already been knocked out.
I'll take a $10 bet with you that we lose the next war.
You know, I can take it because I won't be able to pay it. I mightn't be around.
Yeah, I know.
You'd want me to pay up front.
But what gets me is that when you actually look at the DMO purchasing list of the equipment we are buying, none of it is what I would call the weapons needed for the next war. Now, we are going to buy the Korean self-propelled gun. I mean, that's a start. We have never had self-propelled guns at the moment. We're still doing as they were in World War One, and in fact, you see in the Napoleonic films where they trottle along there either with horses or a truck dragging the gun behind it, and then they park the vehicle and you turn the gun around and you point it in the direction where you want to go and you fire it. Now, in Vietnam, of course, we only had static fire bases, but that's all past. And in fact, there's a new gun actually just come out. It's a Bofors. Where it actually has, it's a 155, by the way, which is as big as anything we've got. It will fire up to 45 kilometers with absolutely deadly accuracy of about 1 to 3 meters. And here's the interesting thing. You've all seen the films where the guy puts the round in the chamber and they fire the gun and he opens the chamber and out comes the round and puts another one in.
Yep.
This one fires 20 rounds automatically from a magazine. And that's a 155. And it will then send 20 rounds off in a minute.
That sounds fairly devastating.
We normally get off about maybe 5 or 6 rounds per minute. This will fire 20 in 1 minute.
So, sorry, that we've acquired this weapon, have we? Or we're sorry, I thought we might have done something like that.
No.
So, Alistair, I suppose it's fair to say that when we see news reports of what's happening, regrettably, in the Ukraine, there are lessons to be learned as to how the Ukrainians are dealing with the onslaught by the Russian forces, particularly with the use of things such as drones and other types of anti-aircraft weapons and so forth. You would no doubt have been not only noticing that, but researching what's going on and what lessons we can learn from the type of weaponry that we've already spent a lot of money on and maybe wasted a lot of money, as to what we should be doing in terms of our defence for the future.
I have. In fact, I've written extensively in magazines about this. I had one published in about drone warfare in the United States. Couldn't get it published in Australia. So I wrote an article there for a magazine called Modern War. And I brought up the subject of drones and how they're being employed and where they're going to go shortly. I mean, it's not the case now. This is not static. This is all changing. And if we're not keeping up with it at all, we're so far behind of doing anything that I believe will actually win the next war. By the way, we formed a thing called the 20th Artillery Regiment, which if you want to type it in and Google it, you'll find it's actually a drone regiment. So we're going to get drones. None of them are armed. They're only for surveillance. I mean, we don't want to hurt anyone.
What is that sort of lunacy? Where's that coming from? We're going to have a fight, but we're not allowed to hurt anyone, but they can thrash us.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
How does that come out of the bloody Defence Department?
Well, let me go off at a bit of a tangent here.
Well, actually, Alistair, I tell you what. It's so interesting. We're going to go to another break very shortly.
And
I noticed that you would have seen an article written by a guy called Clive Williams, and maybe you can talk to us about that. He was a fellow who said, and I'll just read this, because in the first couple of sentences he said Ukraine's most effective weapons in the conflict against Russia have been drones, quad bikes, anti-aircraft, anti-ship and anti-tank missiles, and sniper rifles. Maybe you can come back and address that as soon as we come back from the break.
Election 2022, and Australia decides on Saturday, May 21st. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
The mainstream media would have you believe the Australian federal election in May is a competition between Prime Minister Scott Morrison and opposition leader Anthony Albanese. And Albanese's biggest crime is that he is unable to name the current official Australian Bureau of Statistics unemployment rate, and he was also unable to name the correct interest rate set by the Reserve Bank. Public opinion polling company Roy Morgan issued a release on the 20th of April stating that the Liberal National Party coalition had closed its gap on the Labor Party after Albanese's gaffe, but was still trailing by 10 percentage points on a two-party preferred basis. However, the elephant in the room, which the mainstream media fails to discuss, is the Morrison government's complicity in enabling draconian state government COVID lockdowns and mandates, which have been an utter disaster for millions of Australians. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
Our mission is to educate, inspire, and honor.
This is the sound of honor roaring. This is the sound of a generation rising above.
We want to be involved in the education of young people so that they can take the stories that our pilots tell and realize their own dreams.
The Commemorative Air Force honors the heroes of yesterday while educating and inspiring the heroes of tomorrow. You can learn more at soundsofhistory.org.
You better lock up your sons when the ex-girls hit town. We're an irresistible force. We have the power to get whatever and whoever we want. Let's go. Time to find somewhere hot. We cut through the traffic. No one can stand in our way. Wait there. Don't move a muscle, the paramedic said. Well, the driver said I just ran out in front of him. I can't remember anything, but I've been told I'll be on crutches for a while, and my miniskirt-wearing days are over.
Too much alcohol makes you feel invincible when you're most vulnerable. At least 77% of pedestrians killed in road accidents at night had been drinking. Alcohol. Know your limits.
TNT. Today's News Talk Radio.
And we're back with Politically Incorrect with Mike Tennessee, that's me, and Richard Carson, that's Richard. Mother never called him Dick. No. And also we've got Alistair Pope. Now, Alistair, before the break, we were learning the war lessons of quad bikes and drones from an article that you brought to my notice that was written by Clive Williams. Let's talk some more about that.
Well, I was very annoyed with Clive because he actually stole my thunder, and I had already written a few days before him. Let me read what I've just got the email here that I've played.
Professional jealousy, right.
I was, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'll have to actually make sure he never succeeds. the Russian army has failed comprehensively on multiple levels, but the main one is that they've taken too long to realize they're fighting an asymmetric war. Where are the 500 Ukrainian tanks lined up and ready to slug it out with 2,000 Russian tanks in a repeat of the Battle of Kursk? They aren't. Instead, sneaky armed drones are picking off dozens of armored vehicles, drones are spotting targets for heavy artillery, and lightly armed raiding parties on quad bikes are mad maxing around the fringes and also causing havoc in rear areas. And then if you take out the fact that their sniper rifles are doing rather well, they've taken out 8 Russian generals. And, you know, so you've got this sort of situation here where the Russians went into what they thought was a conventional war, exactly what we are preparing for, and suddenly found out that a number of people on things like quad bikes and with a drone flying overhead to take out your heavy armor. I mean, there's a website, it's actually a South African website, which I sometimes use. I use it actually to write another article on ISIS. And in there, they point out that they don't put any destroyed vehicle up unless they've got a photo of it and its number. So you can actually identify that someone's not just looking at the same photo from 3 different angles and say, well, that's 3 Russian tanks.
Right.
And they pointed out that up to 600 Russian armored vehicles have been destroyed in 40 days, or less than 40 days. Now, that site is pretty accurate from that. They've also got all the planes that have been brought down, the helicopters and everything else, and the photos of them after the crash, and someone's gone off and, you know, basically with a cell phone camera, taken a picture of it, sent it off and said, here's the serial number. So these things are going on, but you've got to actually, what that comes down to, Clive actually got it perfectly right. And we are not fighting an asymmetric, we're not prepared to fight the asymmetric war either. We've announced we're going to buy some missiles. We don't have any, but we're going to get them. We've just got to ask the Chinese to hold off for a few years until we get them. And we haven't, we simply haven't prepared for this next war. Now, one of the things the Japanese found is that we're a long way from Japan. And to get here, they were lucky, actually, they started off by getting Indochina gifted to them by the Vichy French. That allowed them to take out Malaysia and Singapore, and then they came into the Dutch East Indies, where they wanted the oil out of Palembang. And then they took on the north of PNG and also the Solomon Islands. But that was really a far, despite all the hype about the Brisbane line, I mean, that's about as far as they realized they could go. They just didn't have the manpower to go any further. So the Chinese have got 1 million soldiers, and they could, in fact, they're not really tied up elsewhere. They could, in fact, put them in our direct. How are they going to get here?
But
they have to come through other countries, or it's a long way to get on your ship and sail here without being taken out if we had missiles. And weapons to take them out a long way before they hit our shore.
Well, that would be a pretty smart thing to do, wouldn't it?
I would think so, but we're not preparing for that at all. We don't have drones. We don't have armed drones. That's not true. We do have drones for surveillance, but we don't have anything that's armed. We don't have missiles, and we're not capable of actually sending our navy into harm's way somewhere between here and the South China Sea to take on the Chinese Navy.
We might struggle a bit there, wouldn't we? What have we got, 2 or 3 frigates or something or other?
About 6.
6. And they've got how many? 600?
No, they're up to, they're nearly 300 total in warships.
I don't like the odds.
I think there's a recruiting program to get politicians and bureaucrats' sons and daughters to join the Navy.
That'll work well. They'd be getting out of their bloody bed.
Yeah, anyway.
So
What did you say, Mike?
I said you might have to think if you're a member of the naval force.
Well, that'd be a problem. Now, listen, it's horrendously depressing. And we started this question on why the hell is our Defence Department or whatever they're called incapable? You're putting a pretty simple, I don't know if it's simple, but a pretty logical structure in front of myself who knows nothing about defence. And all I'm hearing is we're buying stuff that we could have probably had a bit of a crack in the end of the Second World War or something. What's that, 60, 70 years ago? We've moved on a touch. It just doesn't make any bloody sense at all as to what you're talking about, and we're still mucking around with old-fashioned crap.
No, you might have seen the Minister for Defence Support
has actually
announced that they're cutting down the time for preparing the specifications for military equipment from 4 years to 2 years. So if you come along and say, I would like a new belt for my uniform, according to that, they could take 4 years to actually work out
how to get a new belt.
And then you could have another 2 years of tendering process, and then you can have a dozen committees to actually look at it and come up with whether or not it's woke enough. And you can go through this whole process. I mean, I'll give you one classic.
The more you give me, the more I become ill.
Yeah. Okay, here's a classic example. Do you remember the old Blitz vehicles from World War II?
Yeah, probably had one.
Probably had one. If you had a farm, you probably did. There were thousands of them sold off.
Well, I came from a farm. There was a pretty crappy old truck out there. I know that.
Yeah, well, the Blitz actually was very interesting because the engine was beside the driver. So the driver actually sat right over the front.
Nice.
When we then upgraded to the next series of vehicles, we had the Mark III and the Mark V. And again, the engine was beside the driver. And so the driver was sitting right over the front. The next vehicle we came out then went back to the old style, where you look at any semi-trailer going down the road or any truck going down the road, and the driver sits behind the engine. And that suddenly, everyone had forgotten why we'd put the engine beside the driver and the driver right up the front. It's dead simple, actually. It means that at night, the driver can actually see, can actually have a pinpoint like laser light, and he can actually see 5 to 6 meters in front. If he's got an engine in front of him, he now needs a man with a torch, with a red torch, walking down the track, telling them where the track is so he doesn't fall off the end of the cliff. And so we went right back to what you might have called the 1905 technology, because we'd forgotten the lessons as to why the Blitz actually had the engine beside the driver, why the Mark III and Mark V had the engine beside the driver. And now we were back into saying, well, my God, at night, the driver can't see where he's going. And yet we've got all these specialists who are supposed to test and come up with the ideas for all these vehicles.
But don't they do any research with the people on the ground?
See, the specification may have been for that, but it gets changed because, oh my God, it's so much cheaper if we just go commercial and buy it off someone who's already designed it for driving down the highway. They forget the reason. That's why the Special Forces vehicle became such a camel. In fact, it's a three-legged camel, and it cost $3.75 million.
So how many of those have we got, or have we given them away?
Now, the last time I looked at you, which was in 2022, we'd only produced one.
Oh, good.
We were supposed to get 25 of them, but we haven't actually, because they were unacceptable to Special Forces.
So someone woke up.
The rest yet. That $3.75 million, of course, doesn't include the development costs that we spent several years developing this thing.
I seem to think that's our major project, is to spend a whole lot of dough looking and sounding and carrying on, and then scrapping it and achieving nothing. And then we can move on to the next project where we'll achieve the same amount.
Yeah, and we'll do the same thing.
Yeah. Well,
I mean, one of the things was I pointed out last time was, and I was unaware of it, that Greg Sheridan actually mentioned that on a TV program. I said, he must have had I hope they'd have wine for dinner, because he mentioned we were going to buy the Reaper. The Reaper was declared obsolete by the Americans in 2018. But our procurement process had been so long, we haven't got them yet. It was going to be several more years before we got them. And yet it had already been declared obsolete by the Americans. We didn't get it. We cancelled after a few more million dollars.
So what are we defending ourselves with, broomsticks and shovels? Or
Probably
the old Lee Enfield 303, I assume.
Actually, The weapon we've got now is quite different from anything I would ever carry, like an SLR or an AR-15, or we used to actually have a 303 during training, so that if it got damaged, you weren't going to damage an operational weapon. We're actually just about to go to a new weapon. But the funny thing was that when we got this new weapon, it was actually an Austrian design. We brought it out here. We made some changes to it to make it lighter. And then we found out that when people fired it, the stock had now been changed from wood to plastic. And the plastic heated up and either melted or burnt your fingers. So we had to change that again. Well, it's cheaper than wood.
Oh.
But wood, of course, doesn't transmit heat.
That's why you need an investigative process, don't you? You need a good, expensive investigation process or something like that.
But we do.
But Mike, we didn't work.
Organizations that investigate all of this in all conditions.
Yeah.
We still get it wrong.
Crazy.
I was speechless last time you were telling me about the nuclear submarine fiasco. I'm not getting any better now.
But these are just minor things. I mean, what's a few million here? They're never going to cost us about $200 billion.
Yeah, but what's worrying me is these senior defence personnel. You're making a lot of sense. You're saying, have the Orca unmanned. It can patrol tens of thousands of square kilometres of the ocean and be an effective strike weapon, and we're not even dealing with them.
No, no. I mean, our main focus, we're not dealing with any underwater unmanned vehicles. They're called UUVs, unmanned underwater vehicles. Now, if you have a look at the technology that's coming out, the Americans are actually going ahead with ones that will be able to go thousands of kilometers. They can either be contacted, but they never answer back. So you can actually contact them and say, your mission has changed to do this.
But they don't, therefore, they don't identify themselves.
So they're very hard to find. And right. Of course, being unmanned, if they get caught in a fishing net or some of that happens, then they just destroy themselves.
Now, Alistair, we are in an election mode, some of us, or some they're talking on radio and carrying on. Is there any remote chance, because this is pretty serious stuff that you're highlighting here, of our very erstwhile mainstream media bringing any of this to the consciousness of the Australian voting public?
No. I mean, defence is not... Although it's listed as one of the reasons that people will vote, it's not going to attract their attention. And the only thing that I was going to mention earlier about the war crimes, I actually wrote several articles on it, and the Australian didn't publish two of them, but the Quadrant magazine did publish the other one. And it was about the Yamashita principle and so on. Here's something for you to think about. We sent people to the Boer War. We sent people to Peking in 1901. We fought in World War I, World War II, Malaysia, Borneo, Vietnam, Papua New Guinea, Korea, Iraq, Sudan, Somalia. And the only place where we've had war crimes of the millions of people involved in those conflicts was Afghanistan. Yeah. What are the chances?
Nil, actually, because someone would have done something somewhere that is now considered to be unpalatable to an inner city green woke person.
This became something for the ABC, and I cannot think what the defense was thinking, where they took an investigative journalist and embedded him into the special forces. And he actually was the one who actually put the most submissions in about war crimes. I mean, have a look at what's going on in Ukraine. Are there war crimes being committed in Ukraine? Every day you hear there are. How many people will be prosecuted for those war crimes? It's all over. Zero. Yeah, we are tearing our military apart, destroying its morale. Looking at that, we're getting fewer and fewer people are actually signing up.
That'll be why you're having trouble getting two brigades. You won't get two brigades.
No.
That's your problem. People wouldn't bother.
And yet Morrison announced that we're going to increase the numbers in the army by 18,000 by 2040.
18,000?
By 2040.
It's not a lot in the scheme of things, is it?
No,
that's equivalent to 3 days' casualties at Stalingrad.
Yeah. Well, Alistair, I mean, we might talk a bit more about this because we're going to, at the top of the hour, go to a news bulletin. But, for instance, have a think about this because this is probably what we need to discuss before we get back onto that wonderful topic of politics, which may not be terribly interesting, but we've got a few things to say about it. In any event, because we do have, as Richard said, an election coming up. But I want to focus our mind on what the criteria for success in a modern war are, and whether or not our generals, so to speak,
are up for the job,
are up to the task.
Can they pass the ball or catch it?
No. I'll explain that after the break.
Yeah, okay. Well, we might do that. So we'll probably have a little bit of a running music theme up to the news and come back after the news has gone.